This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, DJ Kool Herc, is considered the first hip-hop DJ, the first to isolate and repeat the breaks of the songs to rev up the party and keep the dancers going. But unlike DJ pioneer Grandmaster Flash, Herc didn't record. In fact, he was eclipsed when hip-hop entered the record world. He says he's much better known now in Europe than in the U.S. He's still DJing here and abroad. There's a chapter devoted to Kool Herc in the new book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation by Jeff Chang. Kool Herc wrote the introduction. There's a CD that accompanies the book that includes a new mix of some of the breaks Herc has played at parties, such as The Mandrill's Fence Walk and Coke Escovedo's I Wouldn't Change a Thing. Herc, welcome to Fresh Air. You're such an interesting figure in hip-hop. You know, everyone who was there at the beginning seems to agree that you started it all. But because you never recorded, in some ways you remain more of a cult figure than a star, a legend for people in the know, but not known to those who aren't really in the know. How do you feel about that status?
It's good. I never chased the glory train. And nobody expected to go this far. And I don't know what the symptom is out there that people that's prominent, that everybody know that they are hip-hop, even call them Godfather and all of that, which in their own right, they have that status. But in the same time, they didn't start it. Although you think people call me the father or the Godfather of hip-hop, no, I'm not. Such name as a Russell Simmons, such name as a P. Diddy that everybody know, which in their own right, they are, you know, Godfathers to what they do in the name of hip-hop. But they didn't start the culture, you know? And I don't have to make a record to be known and all that. My record is hip-hop. Nobody had that title.
Do you wish you had made a record?
No. That's not my thing. There's no regret with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When the record finished and play, you're forgotten about. But when they check the record, who started culture, only one name will come to it, like the presidency. Who started presidency? George Washington. That's who I am to this game. Nobody could take that away from me.
To take us back to the beginning of hip-hop, would you describe what you would do at parties?
Okay. The party would start out like this. I ride my bicycle, summertime, all over the Bronx, everywhere. And people, as I go along, they would ask me, hey, Herc, the last party was the bomb. It was the joint. You know, that's when the first slang thing started. It was the joint. I love it. When is the next one? Until that build up, when is the next one? That's when we give the party. And we give the party 3 weeks prior to the date. We start put our invitations about it on index card. And so if it rain, if it snow, people are still coming because they asked for it. I never gave a party because I want some money to go buy some clothes. I never gave a party to buy some jewelry. I gave a party because people asked me to. And the last one, tell about the next one to come. And I buy records that other people don't have. The record that introduced me to the album, when I buy it, I find out there's two or three more records on there that they should be playing on the radio. And if they don't play it on the radio, then I'm feeling that's what I play for my audience. And sometimes it might 2 or 3 weeks later they start to play it. Then my audience said, wait a minute, Herc played that first.
Tell us what it was like at the party, like how you would play records, how you would find the breaks, how you started finding the breaks.
I would, when I started playing, people didn't see me. I was in a room. I had to stick my head out and see how the party was going. Me and my friends was in the room. And we'd stick our head out and see how the party's going. Or we'd call people names out. And I didn't have the luxury of headphones. I had to cue the record over the music, because that's the way my setup was set up. And I was, you know, the record, you could tell where the breaks are. It's a dark groove. And people used to wait sometime for those particular parts of the record to come on. And I would just play stuff, you know, and I would tell them that I have new records. I want them to check it out at the same time I'm checking it out. And if it's something I'm personally like, I would tell them, I'm feeling this one, and I hope you like the rest I play. You know, because they came to my house. They're my guests.
Mm-hmm. Now, what made you think that it would be great at parties to just play those breaks over and over, to make almost like a loop of those breaks instead of just playing the whole record straight
through?
Because
this is the one misconception of me. I'm a disc jockey. I'm not a DJ. I'm a disc jockey.
Mm-hmm.
I play the disc to make you jockey. And the thing is, I had a format the way I play my music. I play the stuff that's on the radio, and I play the stuff that I feel that should be on the radio, that's not on the radio. And I play records to get you up. I get records to sit you down. I play records to make you good talk over it. And I get you back on the dance floor. And that's my format. Then one day, one night, I experiment. The breaks came out of an experiment by I'm watching the people dancing. A lot of people used to wait for some particular part of the records. I'm studying the floor. I'm like a shepherd. I'm watching the flock, you know. I got to maintain this crowd going on till around 4 o'clock. So I'm very observant. So what I was noticing, people used to wait for them particular parts of the record to dance to, just to do that special little move. So I said, listen, I'm going to do a thing. I'm going to call it the merry-go-round. So I put all these breaks that I know that I have in my collection together. Some of them I have two. Most of them I only have one, so they just have to keep it going. I call it the merry-go-round. And at the time, I had a record called Apache, and it was off an album called The Incredible Bongo Rock. And that record set the tone. And when I did that, that experiment went out the window. Everybody used to come and really wait for that particular part of my format for me to get into it. And that's when the break, everybody started searching for the perfect beat, try to beat that record. And it still can't beat the record until this day, because Nas in 2005 used it. Everybody keep on using Bongo Rock Apache.
So did you rap at all when you started doing parties?
I toast. I just say things that's happening right now, make a little skit out of it. I talk in between the records. And after a while, you put a bunch of those little things together, you have a little rap. You know, you could run off a little miniature rap. But I wasn't never into the rap. My partner, Coke LaRock, was more doing the poetic part of it. You know, so I have poems. And he used to give me some little poems, like how Ali used to come out with those little poems,
mm-hmm,
that his side man used to give him. That's how Coke LaRock is.
You said what you did was more like a toast. Now, you grew up in Jamaica. You moved to New York when you were about 13. And toasting is a Jamaican thing. Why don't you describe what a toast is?
Yeah, it's just like you say, you know, you're coming down to check guy. You never heard it like this before, and you're back for more and more and more. This is a rockness. You see a rock with the rockers and jam with the jammers, young lady, don't hurt nobody. Because remember, it's no fun without we all get some. And the story can be told, and the bull can be stopped, and in a disco I can rock, herk, herk. And guys, a guy named Dickie, he passed away, but he always tells me like this, herk, I want you to say this on the mic. Who's the man with the master plan from the land of Gracie Grace? Herk, herk. You know who live at Gracie Grace, shortening? The mayor, Gracie Mansion. I was the mayor of the Bronx.
Now, in Jamaica, where you grew up, the B-side of a lot of records was just an instrumental
version, yes.
Yeah, and I think the idea was that you could like toast or sing over the instrumental.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Did that influence you at all growing up with all those B-side instrumentals?
Oh, yes, most definitely. It made me go more into the record more than just play one side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Would you describe one of the best parties that you can remember? From the early days of hip-hop?
All of them was good. All of them. But I couldn't... I just can remember sometime I played some particular record that I remember that when we first heard a record called 7 Minutes of Funk, we heard it in a place called at Hunts Point. And Jay-Z used it. And a few other people used that same record. And that came out of my collection. And when we played that record, or what we did, Coke did it. Coke put the record on, and we all walked off the stage. And the record just came on. Boom, 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 boom. And it kept on going. And it just kept on going through changes. And everybody was like, whoa. You know, even when we play Heat Wave, the slow record, you know, everybody was shocked because we played a lot of records that the radio wasn't playing. Till we find out the radio station started sending spies to the clubs to hear what we playing. That's a lot of the records now start to get played on the radio.
My guest is DJ Kool Herc. He's considered the father of hip-hop DJs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kool Herc, and he's basically considered the father of hip-hop, of
DJing. No, not basically. I am.
Okay. And
the Kool- buck stopped right here. There's nobody after George Washington. Likewise, same thing for Kool Herc.
Okay, and Kool Herc wrote the introduction for a new book called Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, and there's a whole chapter devoted to him as well. How long did you have this territory to yourself, you know, of DJing at parties?
I dominated the whole 70. Mm-hmm. I take the 70. I take it from the beginning to the end of it. That's when everything else started to pop off.
Okay, by
Sugar Hill started 79 with
exactly.
Rapper's Delight. The 70 was Kool Herc's.
What was your reaction when you heard Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, which was basically the first rap record? Did you expect
It was the first rap hit. No, it was the first rap hit record.
Good point. Right. Right.
It was King Tim III who made the first whack rap record.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't know anything, they should have used one of their hit records. And then they would grab people's attention, like Big Leg Girls or Dancing in the Street or Bus Stop. They were sounding bougie. They had that downtown bougie sound.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first whack rap record, and Sugar Hill had the first hit rap record. And it was just letting me know, hey, man, this thing is here to stay. All the heat, all the hate I was getting, oh, the rap business is going to end next week, and it's a fad. And a lot of them people that was knocking it, now they're trying to jump on board. Now our stuff then rose to dominance worldwide. Now they want to switch over. Their stuff died. Disco died. My stuff wasn't disco. We played a little bit of the disco, but just for the people.
What were the records that you thought had the best breaks when you were doing parties in the 70s?
James Brown, Give It Up, Turn It Loose. A lot of James Brown record, Get Involved. Bobby Bird record, Hot Pants, you know, and Dennis Coffey, you know, Scorpio. Soundtracks from Shaft in Africa, you know, and the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still buying records to this day.
What are you buying?
Good stuff that's not played on the radio.
Now, you were telling me before we started recording that when you were doing parties, you didn't want people to know the records you were playing. Why not?
No, that's the thing. That's the same thing from Jamaica. You can't do that. You don't want everybody to go down the block. You want them to come to you. There's no choice. You got to come to you to edit. That's why they got a thing called exclusive. You know, so you can't tell everybody the records. Now, if everybody have the record there, they won't come to see you or hear you. Why go there when we can hear it down here? If I get a record right now, it's the bomb. Nobody's going to get the name of it till I rep it, till my name attached to it.
Okay.
To any DJ that I play, anybody say, yeah, we heard her play that first. I'm not giving it up. No, I'm going to dog it till I get my name attached to it.
So when did you stop doing parties?
I never did stop.
Mm-hmm.
I never did stop. I just reclined and just went on into my business. And then as it went along, you know what came into play one time? You know, people start to smoke. You know, the 80s and the crack thing, man, I almost got swept up in that.
But you didn't?
And I took a vacation from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to daytop and straightened my life out.
Mm-hmm.
And the music wasn't going anywhere. And I got my life back on track. And I'm here, 15 years drug free.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
You moved to New York in 1967 from Jamaica. at the age of 13. What was your first reaction to New York? You moved to what, to the South Bronx?
No, I moved on the West Bronx on Tremont Avenue, 178th Street, 611 East 178th Street.
Okay. So and, what was your first reaction to it, and how did it compare to the neighborhood you were used to in Jamaica?
Well, I was at the time watching TV down there, Petticoat Junction and Dennis the Menace, and I just thought all the United States was like good old Mr. Wilson, Dennis the Menace neighborhood. I was in for a rude awakening when I got here. I was living in Jamaica originally in Jonestown, you know, Trenchtown over there on 2nd Street. Bob Marr lived on 1st Street. I lived on 2nd Street nearby, a little school nearby. I attended a school nearby, a movie theater called the Ambassador Theater. And when I moved to Franklin Town and got more into seeing the disco develop, I didn't live in a ghetto part of Jamaica, Franklin Town, you know. It was like a little suburbia, but it was probably something about me ghetto. But when I got here, it was like, it was no different. I'm like, whoa. I'm living upstairs over other people, people living over me. I lived in a yard in Jamaica. I had a yard. I didn't live in a tenement, you know. And I see dirt. I didn't see concrete all the time, you know. And snow. I never seen snow before, you know, and it was like a wake-up call. It wasn't the good old Mr. Wilson neighborhood.
What surprised you most about what the styles were when you got to New York? You know, were the clothes different?
I didn't have the hip clothes. I had on the hick clothes. I had on the aviator hat that you pull over your ears and the flip-up top. I had the wide corduroy jacket on. I looked straight like a hick. And then I had on, I love cowboy boots. I'm back in Jamaica and watching cowboy pictures. So I thought, cowboy boots was the bomb. When I got in and got a pair of cowboy winter boots, this girl in high school, junior high school, teased me to death. Yeah, look at him. He got on Rhodes Killers. And she had the whole hallway just tearing me up. Rhodes Killers and all that. Do you know I seen her one time years later? I said, remember me? She said, yeah, I remember you. I used to tease you about them random cowboy boots. And I said, look around the place right now. What do you see? She said, oh, my God. I said, yeah, I guess I was ahead of my time then, right? Sure, you're right. It was cowboy style was in. When Teddy Pendergrass made that record and had on the cowboy hat and all that.
But they called your cowboy boots Roach Killers.
Yes, that is pointy toe. They called any pointy toe shoes like that. It was called Roach Killers. Okay, you could get in a corner and kill a roach with it.
I think before you actually started DJing, you were writing graffiti.
Yes, I was a great big follower of Tacky 183.
Oh yeah, he was one of the first famous names on the wall.
We looked up to him like the god of graffiti.
Uh-huh.
And we thought to do that. Me and a friend of mine called Uncle Rich, Lightning 163, Super Cool, Face 2. And we was tagging names, you know, Clyde as Cool Herc. People couldn't call me by my real name. The closest it could come to it was the Knicks basketball player. So I said, okay, my name is Clyde. But my name is Clive, C-L-I-V-E, like Clive Davis, who gave Whitney Houston, you know, her big break.
Yeah. But could people not pronounce Clive?
Right.
They couldn't pronounce it.
They got a clip. So you mean like the guy who played on the basketball for the Knicks, Clyde? Yeah, Clyde. Okay, Clyde. Yeah, call me Clyde.
So what was your tag? Clyde as cool?
Clyde as cool.
And how did the as cool come about?
Because back in Jamaica, there was a commercial, I think it was an English cigarette brand. The brand name was Silver Thin. And this guy was driving an Aston Martin, one of them James Bond car. With the old coolness and the black glove, the dark shades, and this, and the girl sitting beside him, and she touched a cigarette, and he slammed on the brakes, and opened the door and pointed his finger to get out, and I thought that was cool, so I kept that in my head, and I said when I was on the block, we was picking nicknames, and I picked cool. And at school, I was playing very aggressive basketball, and this guy on his. People started putting nicknames on me. Lurds, Cyclops, Samson. And I shut it down quick. Don't do that. Don't call me that. My name is Clive. You know, call me that. Or, of course, call me Cool. Forget about them big names, okay? So this guy started calling me Hercules. And I'm like, yo, man, please, that's too drastic, man. I ain't no Hercules. So I went back. I know what he meant by, you know. So I went back to the block with it. I said, yo, fellas, man, this guy on the sideline keep on calling me Hercules. So I said, what's the shortening for Hercules? They said, Herc. I said, that sounds unique. It didn't say what it is, strength, but it won't give me the whole Hercules to it. So I said, listen, call me Herc. He said, all right, Herc. All right, cool. And before you know it, the name Clyde was dropped and become Cool Herc.
DJ Cool Herc will be back in the second half of the show. He wrote the introduction to the new book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. The book devotes a chapter to Herc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with DJ Cool Herc. He's considered the father of hip-hop DJs. Back in the mid-70s, when he was the number one DJ at parties in the Bronx, he originated the style of isolating and repeating the breaks, the most danceable parts of a record. He never made any records of his own, but he's still DJing. There's a chapter devoted to him in the new book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. Herc also wrote the book's introduction. How did you actually start DJing at parties?
Well, my sister was the first person to ask me to play. You know, I was collecting records and stuff. I was buying my records. I was playing my records in the house. And at the time, graffiti was getting out of hand. And my father is a disciplinarian. He'd mop up the floor with me if he knew his son was destroying public property and all that type of stuff. So she asked me to play at a back-to-school party for her. She was working at a youth. She was doing a summer job, and she saved the money. And she wanted some extra money to go down to Delancey Street, Orchard Street, to buy some clothes. And in 2005 term, she wanted to flip her money. And she asked me to help her flip the money. She said, Herc, since a lot of people know you and you got a lot of friends, you know, you popular, and how about playing, you know, for my party? And I did. And the rest was history.
So the party went so well, you got a reputation immediately?
Yeah, I got the rep. I used the curiosity to find out who Cool Herc is. I remember I was on the, you know, I was the person that they didn't know who it was, writing Cool Herc. And now you see my name on a flyer, an index card, a time and a place.
Uh-huh.
So that curiosity bring people in. Now they come, then they come and say, oh, he's not short, he's tall, he's huge, and the sound system is powerful, and okay, so that's what he looked like. And still they didn't really know who I was because I wasn't running around saying, I'm Cool Herc. So, and then the people in the neighborhood already know me already, and the rest was history.
Who were the early dancers like at your parties?
Oh, the early dancer was Coke LaRock, a guy called Sasa. We named him the number one B-boy. And he got Trixie. He got Wallace D. He got a guy called James Bond, the Amazing Bobo, Sister Boo. I do my little dance, too.
What did you think the first time that you saw break dancers, you know, spinning on their head and doing...
We never called it break dancing. That was a part of the climax, the routine.
Uh-huh.
And I just said, go off, break. It's freestyle. It was never break dance. It's freestyle. And at part of your routine, you would break. Mm-hmm. You would go into a frenzy. You would go to take it to another level. So we call it, say, go off, break.
So when you first started seeing dancers doing that,
yeah,
what was your reaction?
It was not a record. We used to do it. I used to do it. I would jump out in a circle and do my little thing.
What was your thing?
And Coke LaRock used to, he's an A1 B-boy too, you know?
So
the B-boy that stands for break boy, the boy that's going to go out there and break. You know, that don't mean break dancing. This means freestyle. A part of the routine, they would break. They would go off. They would go postal. You know, watch out.
You're still doing a lot of DJing.
I think
you told me you just did 3 weeks in Australia?
Yes, Sydney, Port. I did Brisbane, Melville, Perth, Bondi, Gold Coast, Sydney. I did all, and a couple of places I couldn't remember. And I was down there for the Aerial Award, which they had a new category called the Urban Category, which is hip hop. And this group called Coolism won.
Are you still playing the records that you played in the 70s, or are
Yes,
you...
I take them on a learning experience. I take them from then and now. I take them on a journey.
So
right up to now.
Do you play a lot of contemporary records too, or just older stuff?
The ones I'm feeling.
Uh-huh.
I don't play everything. I play contemporary, and some people don't like it, but I just let them know it's a personal thing. Let them know my ears is not just in the past. It's about now, right here.
So what do you like that's contemporary?
Well, I like Talib Kweli. I like some of Mos Def. I like LL Cool J. I haven't played Jill Scott in the club in Sydney, Australia. This girl couldn't believe she thought she in her wildest dreams. She said, I never thought I would hear what Jill Scott record play in a disco, a club. And you played it. You played it.
Now, back in the 70s when you were doing parties, you'd charge for admission, right?
25 cents for fellas, for ladies, and 50 cents for fellas. After that, it was 75 for fellas, 50 cents for ladies. We was charging according to what the Juicy Fruit gum was selling for. We budgeted ourselves according to we were trying to get rich. You know, if the soda was 50 cents, we got to charge 25 cents for ladies. I mean, the gum was 20, if the gum was a dime, a nickel, we got to charge 50, you know, like that. We wasn't trying to get rich.
So how many people would show up to the typical party?
I'll tell you one thing. We went upstairs, we poured it out on the table. We made $500 selling Franks and all that. $300 to $400 we was clocking. So, and there's a little recreation room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you have to pay to rent the room?
Yes, $25.
Oh, it's not bad.
No. Yeah, it was just, you know, it was fun. And at the time, people didn't want nobody in their house. Mom still paying for the furniture. People is not going to be too careful in your house. You don't want people all up in your business. So the recreation was perfect. You couldn't tear nothing up in there. We had two bathrooms, we had a kitchen, and we had space to dance.
So a lot of the apartment buildings had recreation rooms?
Yeah, a few of them. Mm-hmm. At least the new one. We live in a new building at the time because we was burnt down from where we lived at on the east side. And we stayed in the Grand Concourse Hotel for a minute. And my mom's held out till something came along. And it was the first building on Cedric Avenue, right by the Major Deacon Highway. They say, Mrs. Campbell, we think we have something you're looking for. And sure enough, we found it, two bathrooms and enough room for all of us. It was the Brady Bunch family, three boys and three girls. And we lived on the first floor. And I'll tell you this, you know who lived on top of us?
Who?
And their moms and my moms work at the same place, the Rough Riders.
I should know them, right?
Well, Eve come from the camp.
Okay.
DMX come from the camp.
Oh, okay.
The Deans, we family. They when I was playing my music downstairs on the second floor where everybody was dancing outside, they live on the third floor. Their moms had to bang on my door, Herc, please, please, my kids, they got to go to sleep. My babies. And look at them now. They are very big in the music business called the Rough Riders. Juan King, you know, Mark. You know, yeah.
Have you ever done a radio show?
No.
Do you think that's something you'd want to do sometime? Show. You know, like to DJ on the radio.
I would love it, but I'd have to have free reign to play what I'll play.
Uh huh.
And you don't get that at radio stations, so I don't really bother with it.
Right.
You can't tell me what to play in New York City when this culture was born here.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
DJ Kool Herc wrote the introduction to the new book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. The book devotes a chapter to Herc.